Hi, everybody. This is Marlene with Erie News, and today is April 11, 2024. Wednesday, April 11, 2024. And we're going to start off with something from Stranger Than Fiction Stories. And this one is titled The Nurse and the Hand of Death. In the fall of 1923, a woman's savagely beaten body was found under the portico of the deserted Hussey Mansion at Center Avenue and Cypress Street, adjacent to the homeopathic hospital in Pittsburgh. Underneath her body was found an envelope with the hand of death, consisting of the playing cards, an ace, a deuce, a tray of diamonds, and the five of spades. The woman's body was discovered by Alexander McConnell when he was walking across the property. By then, a nurse that lived at 4620 Carroll Street had been reported missing by her family. Her name was Elsie Barbara Barthel, 28, who, according to her relatives, planned to pay a certain self-proclaimed voodoo doctor for a love charm. The information was provided by Elsie's sister, Laura Barthel, and John G. Kite, a brother-in-law. At the coroner's inquest, it was revealed Elsie had died from fractures to her skull and that she was pregnant. Known for her sterling reputation, perhaps it was these desperate circumstances that drove her to seek the help of Lorenzo Savage. Savage, 25, had once worked as a butler for Dr. R.S. Marshall at his home office located at 424 Shady Avenue. This is how they met, since Miss Barthel worked for the doctor as a nurse secretary for the past 3 years. By the time of the murder, he had left the employ of Dr. Marshall, and Savage worked in the home of C.S. Mitchell on 327 South Street, where both he and his wife Regina Taylor, also known as Pearl Savage, were employed. Unfortunately for Savage, the police found one of his handkerchiefs close to the body. Also, the fact that a conversation was overheard by her family when he called asking for Elsie to meet him at a certain location for a love potion. The family was mystified since they thought that all was well between Elsie and her fiancé, Walter Harry Hall. Elsie's death had been brutal. Her head was crushed, and beside her lay an envelope with the bewitched cards. There was also an empty, blood-splattered envelope that had once contained money for curing her love ills. Police traced Savage to a party he was attending with his wife. They were both arrested, but eventually his wife would be released. Police searched the room where they stayed and found a deck of cards, which were identical to the ones found with the body, and they were missing the ones left at the scene. The spell consisted of Savage giving her six cards, held together by a black pin, and she was told the charm would work if she returned the cards to him and paid him the money on the night she was killed. The police also held Walter Hall, Elsie Barthel's sweetheart, when they found two of her handkerchiefs in his pocket and discrepancies on the stories he told before and after Savage's arrest. Elsie and Walter had been involved for several years and were slated to marry only a month later in November. Savage told police he took a ride in Hall's taxi from East Liberty to Bedford Avenue to the Bedford Avenue house where he lived after leaving the scene of the crime. Police thought it was a strange coincidence that it was Hall who picked up Savage as a fare. Walter Hall had fainted when he was shown his fiancée's body at the morgue. Her burial was scheduled for October 10, 1923. When Walter Hall was brought into the station, he spied Savage, which was already there. He pointed out this was the same man that asked for a fare to the East End. When Savage saw Hall, he confessed to the murder after maintaining his innocence up to that point. Within 24 hours after committing the crime, Savage returned to the mansion and reenacted the murder for the police. He said Elsie had come to him and said she was having trouble in her love affairs. This is when he gave her the six cards. She was to perform certain rites over them and return the cards to him on the assigned Saturday night with $395, equivalent to $6,000 present day. Police were searching also for a certain Will Rogers, a mystery man in the case, since Savage declared the girl gave his name as that of the sweetheart responsible for her pregnancy. According to Savage, resolution of the love triangle was the cure she was seeking. Police investigated if the ace, deuce, tray of diamonds, and the five of spades was the hand of death. They consulted with a mystic named Itella, known as the dean of all fortune tellers, who said the original mark of death was the four aces of any suite. He clarified the ace of diamonds meant a letter or a written notice of something about to happen. Other amateur fortune tellers said the deuce and tray of diamonds meant a warning was sent regarding something about to happen, and any black card up to the 10th spot meant that something dark was about to occur in your life. This tended to bear out the police's theory that the cards clutched in Elsie's hands was a warning sent to her. Cards were used profusely in the southern part of the United States in the practice of the voodoo medicine doctors in the days before the Civil War, and were still used for those who believed in voodooism. Lorenzo Savage's family were from Virginia. Despite being a nurse, could Elsie have thought that a voodoo charm could relieve her of her pregnancy, which would mean her disgrace? Or perhaps she thought that the man who had made her pregnant would marry her after all. She knew her fiancé would not be happy to find that not only had she been with another man, but was pregnant with his child. Desperate situations make people believe the ridiculous. According to Savage, he struck Elsie in the face when she took the envelope with the money back, and she fell against the small wall along the side of the carriage entrance. As she fell, he said she screamed, "I'll give it to you," but he picked up a brick and threw it at her head. She lay still after that, and then he saw the large heavy stone lying on the wall around the carriage entrance directly over the woman's head. He pushed the stone from the wall and it crushed her skull, causing her death. Once he made sure she was dead, he took the envelope with the money. He walked off the property, and when he reached Highland and Penn Avenues, he hailed a cab. He opened the envelope and, according to him, found it contained only $32 and not the $395 he expected. He didn't go home and instead spent $21 in the Hill District. The police said he blamed the victim for the crime, believing that if she had cooperated, nothing would have happened. Police interviewed Minerva Rosauer, a dietitian at the homeopathic hospital, and William Mickler, who escorted her home. She described was shortly after 11 p.m., an automobile containing three persons came up the driveway to the hospital, stopped a few minutes, and later backed into Center Avenue. A short time later, the same auto, which had been parked on Center Avenue, was again driven over the Hussey property and stopped under the portico of the mansion. They heard a piercing scream and then the cry, "Don't do that." They saw no struggle, and a short time later, the auto drove away. Savage came to trial in November 1923 and pled not guilty. Frequently referred to as Alonzo Savage by the press, he was described as small in stature, and he dressed in chicish clothes with pearl buttons and bell-bottom trousers when he attended court. Despite his confession, with a minute detail of using a 70-pound piece of masonry to end the girl's life, he later recanted. He said Elsie Barthel was alive when he left the Hussey Mansion. Allegedly, she told him she was waiting to meet her sweetheart there. He said the police had made him confess to the murder. The authorities denied it. During the trial, Elsie's mother described that on October 3rd, her daughter had received a call. She was home because she was on vacation. She heard Elsie say she would have $15 bill and some pennies in an envelope. After she hung up, the mother asked who had called. She said it was Lorenzo. He called her again on October 6th, and she left the house about 8:30 p.m. This was the last time her mother saw her alive. Mrs. Barthel then told of $400, most of which had been borrowed, were later found in Elsie's room on the floor. It seems she had taken only about $30 when she left that night. Laura Barthel, Elsie's sister, testified she had given her sister the 15 $1 bills. Under cross-examination, it was brought out that Savage was well acquainted with the Hussey Mansion since he attended several dances there given by the Chauffeurs Club. Then it was known as Thornton Grove, a well-known lover's lane that had taken over once the building was abandoned. Minerva Rosauer testified that Elsie Barthel's sweetheart was known as Rogers and that he worked at the Homestead Mills. She had seen him several times but never spoken to him. During the trial, Savage identified a young man in the courtroom as Rogers, but according to the detective, his name was John R. Doherty. Nothing ever came of this lead. Could Savage have been in cahoots with either Hall, the mysterious Mr. Doherty, or a third unknown party who had not expected he would kill the nurse, perhaps when she told him she had only brought $30 and not the windfall of $395? Perhaps the automobile Minerva Roser saw at the mansion was the parties returning to make sure Elsie Barthel was indeed dead. The wheels of justice turned quickly in those years, and by December 1923, Savage had been convicted for the murder. Savage was executed on March 31, 1924, by electrocution. The body was not claimed and he was buried in the penitentiary cemetery. Walter Harry Hall moved out to California and married a woman named Grace. He died in 1965 without any family around. And this is, you know, again, no, well, maybe the family knew, who knows, but here she's engaged to one guy, about to get married. She gets killed like supposedly a month before she's to a man that she's been involved with in a month's time. But apparently she's having this romance and she gets pregnant. And this is the thing. She was a nurse. In other words, she understood medicine to the point of that, you know, what was she going to think this was going to do for her? Well, the pregnancy's there. There's no way to get rid of it without charm. So I don't know. That thing, you know, desperate times require desperate measures, but sometimes some of those things, they unfortunately lead to, you know, like desperation makes you, I don't know, expect certain things are going to turn out a different way. And of course they don't. Sad story. Anyway, the next one is also out of Stranger Than Fiction Stories, and it's titled Ghosts of the British Raj. And here we go. In 1903, Colonel Barog, a British engineer, made a mistake in the building of tunnel number 33 on the Calcutta-Shimla train route. Subsequently, he was fined for wasting government money and publicly reprimanded, which humiliated him deeply. He rode his horse to the dark entrance of the unfinished tunnel and shot himself in sheer desperation near what now is state government-run Barog Pinewood Hotel. He has never left the place since. He was buried in front of the tunnel, and a signboard giving details about the sad end of Colonel Barog was put up near his grave. But that tune has now disappeared. As a result, it is now even difficult to locate the whereabouts of his grave. Sightings of the engineer riding his horse from one end to the other started almost immediately after his death. It is said that he tried to have conversations with those who see him. Strangely, there is no reference made of a Colonel or Mr. Barog in connection with the tunnel or his death in those years by the newspapers at this tunnel or any other that was constructed. However, as early as 1878, there is mention made of Barog Hill. In 1900, there is reference made to the actual construction of the tunnel as the Barog Tunnel under the Solon Hill, prior to the arrival of any engineers. The tunnel was completed 3 years later and inaugurated by Lord Curzon on November 9, 1903. Barog is a village located about 27 miles away from tunnel number 33, and it's the eighth station on the railroad from Calca. It turns out Colonel Barog is a fictional character in an urban myth. If there's a ghost hunting the area, it's not the mythic engineer. Now, and that's interesting because sometimes how these urban myths come along. There was nobody. In other words, the Barog really talks of is connected to a village that was already there. That maybe something like that happened, but there was no reference to it. So unless it was a totally different name, but yeah, this is how these urban myths they morph into, and then when you do a little research, you find that they're not that accurate. Now this other story has to do with the Biraj Bawan Palace, which was built in 1830 by the East India Company for the British political agent. It is said to be haunted by Major Charles Burton, who was killed in the Indian Mutiny in 1857. Both of his sons were killed as well. He supposedly stalks the quarters of the palace, and on occasion slaps guards who have fallen asleep at their post. The palace was made into a hotel in 1980. Again, you know, this Major Charles Burton did exist and his sons were killed in and around this place, and apparently this is what he's known for. Another ghost that's supposed to haunt there from the time of the Raj was Warren Hastings, and he is said to haunt his one-time home in Kolkata. He, along with Major General Lord Robert Clive, consolidated the hold of the East India Company during the 18th century for the British Empire. He became the first Governor General of British India. There are reports of the sounds of a phantom coach arriving, and the shade of a man looking through drawers and shuffling papers. There are stories told of the ghost of a British woman who wanders through the gardens. It is believed to be Hastings' wife, Marion. Hastings left the property to his stepson Julius Imhoff, who lived there as did several later generations of the family. Different authors wrote ghost stories during what is known as the British Raj, which lasted from 1858 to 1947. The best known are Rudyard Kipling, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, B.M. Croker, which stands for Bithia Mary Croker, Brigadier Humphrey Bullock, and Charles Lindley, Viscount Halifax. Simla was the summer capital for the British Raj, and many of the houses and bungalows have tales of murder and hauntings attached to them. Viscount Halifax wrote a story in his 1937 book titled The Simla Bungalow that was sent to him in 1925 by his sister, Mrs. Dundas, who had it from her granddaughter in India. The story details where the ghost of an old man was seen leaning on a stick and staring at the floor. Later it was learned that an older man, in a fit of jealousy, had killed his young wife in this house years before. There's another story told involving Victor Bailey, Assistant Secretary, Railway Board and Superintendent of Munitions, India. He and his wife came to India around 1913 and rented a home in the lush hills of Simla. It was a mansion and let at a low rent. What they didn't know was the reason why others were reluctant to live there. By the time they came to occupy it, the house was approximately 50 years old and built shortly after the mutiny in 1857. It had a reputation for being haunted. The prior occupants would hear crashes in the house, and the belongings in a room were torn apart without human agency. The Baileys stayed for the season without incident until a night when they returned from a party and found a trusted servant waiting for them. He described how he noticed an English gentleman walking around in the house. He followed the man and asked if he wanted anything. The man didn't respond and walked through a closed door. The Baileys left soon after, whether due to the ghost or the end of the summer season is not known. The house became known as the Charleville Mansion and retained its disturbing reputation. It was sold to an Indian family in 1947. Bailey, as an engineer, would go on to be involved in the building of the railway at the Khyber Pass, along 30 miles of the frontier between India and Afghanistan. He authored a book about his experiences in the 1930s. He wrote, quote, "The utter indifference to human life and suffering was simply appalling. The whole land seemed to be tainted with it. From the hard, clean skyline to the bare, stony field that seemed to breathe hostility and murder," end quote. Lothian Cemetery in Delhi is one of the oldest Christian cemeteries located not far from the Kashmir Gate on Lothian Road, thus its name. Burials took place there from 1808 until 1867. Present day, it is derelict, full of crumbling crosses poking from the weeds. Only 15% of the tombs are decipherable. It has a reputation for being very haunted. European soldiers who were killed during the mutiny of 1857, as well as British women and children who died from cholera epidemics, found their final resting place at this graveyard. Supposedly, there is the ghost of Sir Nicholas, who committed suicide after a failed love affair with an Indian woman. There is no story written in the English newspapers about the death of any British gentleman by that name, either dying from illness or by his own hand. The connection might be to the Nicholson Christian Cemetery, around the corner from the Kashmiri Gate. The 4 acres contain the grave of Brigadier General John Nicholson, who died on November 21, 1857, from injuries sustained during the storming of Delhi during the Sepoy Mutiny of 1857. He was only 35 years old. The story of the suicidal gentleman is most probably an urban myth, as there are men aplenty buried at Lothian Cemetery who died under grislier circumstances, who could be a spirit seen walking the grounds. Since some of the most intense combat occurred near the Kashmir Gate and St. James Church, where a small British community lived just inside the city walls in 1857, were massacred, not all of the victims received a decent burial, as testified by the inscription of a huge Celtic cross of rose sandstone, with a message sacred to the memory of those whose nameless graves lie all around. Between May 11th to the 17th, scores of British women, men, and children were captured and put to the sword by rebels under a peepul tree that grew in this neighborhood. This included Mitchley John Jennings, the chaplain. The peepul tree is gone, but the chapel is still there. It was built in 1836 by James Skinner, also known as Sikandar Sahib, the son of an Indian princess and a Scotsman. He founded the British cavalry regiment Skinner's Horse, which remained loyal during the mutiny. Skinner is buried under the chancel pavement, and even though he was allegedly Christian, not so much when it came to marriage, for he had 14 wives. Two epitaphs, the result of the horrifying summer of 1857, read, quote, "Sacred to the memory of Geoffrey Beresford, Esquire, Sarah Beresford, his wife, and their five daughters, Rebecca, Charlotte, Emily, Agnes, and Ellen, all of whom fell victims to the mutiny of the native army at Delhi in May 1857. Their sun has gone down while it is yet day." Another says, "John Ross Hutchinson, Esquire, BCS, in the face of imminent perils, he did not shrink, though warned of the danger from discharging his duties as magistrate of Delhi, and was murdered by the rebels on the 11th of May, 1857, in the 36th year of his age. Yea, through I walked to the valley of the shadow of death." So there you go. So again, you know, I'm sure some of these ghost stories, you know, they kind of, maybe they have had sightings, but then you're not really sure really who the origin is. In other words, maybe they see somebody walking around, they make up the fictional character, but that's not exactly who's walking around there. God knows, you know, especially when you have like what you had, all those sudden deaths and those epidemics, of course, it's a given you're going to have somebody walking around that's never gotten the memo about the you passed away. Anyway, next story is out of WECB Radio. It's titled, "A Gigantic Ocean Discovered 700 Kilometers Beneath the Earth's Surface." Imagine the vast expanse of the world's oceans. Now picture an underwater realm three times that size, not across the globe's surface, but tucked away deep beneath it at a depth of 700 kilometers. This isn't the plot of a sci-fi novel, but the startling discovery made by a team of scientists unraveling the mysteries of our planet's water origins. The quest to pinpoint the origins of Earth's water has led researchers to a monumental find. A colossal ocean ensconced within the Mare's mantle, over 700 kilometers below the surface. This hidden ocean, concealed within a blue rock known as Ringwoodite, challenges our understanding of where Earth's water came from. The size of the subterranean sea is so vast that it triples the volume of all the planet's surface oceans combined. This discovery not only fascinates with its scale, but also proposes a new theory about Earth's water cycle. It suggests that instead of arriving via comet impacts, as some theories have posited, Earth's oceans may have slowly seeped out from its very core. Steve Jacobson, a researcher at Northwestern University in Illinois and the lead author of the study, says, "This is tangible evidence that water on Earth came from within." According to Jacobson, this hidden reservoir could also explain why the size of the world's oceans has remained consistent over millions of years. To unearth this underground ocean, researchers employed an array of 2,000 seismographs across the United States, analyzing seismic waves from over 500 earthquakes. These waves, which travel through Earth's inner layers, including its core, slow down when passing through wet rock, allowing scientists to deduce the presence of this vast water deposit. The presence of water within the Earth's mantle, sweating along the edges between grains of rock, could reshape our understanding of the planet's water cycle. Jacobson points out the significance of this reservoir. Without it, the water would be on the Earth's surface, and mountaintops might be the only land visible. Now, with this groundbreaking discovery, researchers are keen on gathering more seismic data from around the world to determine if this mantle melting is a common occurrence. Their findings could revolutionize our understanding of the water cycle on Earth, offering new insights into one of our planet's most fundamental processes. I think that's super interesting. But I'm telling you, a lot of people, don't get me wrong, I'm okay with exploring, you know, outer space, you know, Elon and Mars and all that. But there's so much here on Earth to discover, so many mysteries, okay? I think like stuff like this, you know, like really that the theories that they had so far is how we got our oceans might be totally, no, it seems that it is totally wrong. So anyway, let's go back to Stranger Than Fiction Stories. And the next story is titled Discoveries of the Ship Endurance and Other Antarctic Mysteries. All right, let's see. Here we go. The Endurance was found 4 miles from where her captain, Frank Worsley, reported her going down in 1915. It wasn't only the loss of the ship which made this endeavor so famous, but the tribulations the crew had to endure in order to reach safety. To cross Antarctica from the Weddell Sea via the South Pole to the Ross Sea, this was Sir Ernest Shackleton's dream. He sailed in 1912 from Norway with a crew of 27 men. The year before, Roald Amundsen's expedition was the first to successfully reach the South Pole. Supplies were left on Ross Island at Hut Point. The outpost was built in 1902 during the National Antarctic Expedition led by Robert Falcon Scott. Despite the preparations, nature did not favor the expedition since the ice was denser than normal and the Endurance became trapped on the Weddell Sea in January 1915. In February, Shackleton converted the ship to a winter station since he realized she would be stuck until the following spring. The ice was so thick that even under steam power, it couldn't make headway. The vessel drifted along for hundreds of miles, its engines silent since it was thought prudent to conserve coal. With warmer temperatures, she was released, but it put extreme pressure on the hull. In July, a gale pushed ice into the ship's hull, and 3 months later, Shackleton abandoned the ship, moving 3 lifeboats and supplies to the ice. The Endurance sank on November 21st. The 28 men capped on ice floes that drifted northward, living on seal and meat made up of the 70 sled dogs sent for the expedition. They stayed there 2 months, hoping to reach Paulet Island, 250 miles away, where there was a cache of supplies. The icy landscape was so inhospitable that they could not reach their destination. In April, the ice released them and they traveled in open boats to Elephant Island at the tip of the Antarctic Peninsula. Chance of being rescued was unlikely since the island was far away from any shipping routes. Shackleton and 5 other men then made an 800-mile trip to South Georgia on the 20-foot lifeboat James Caird. Once there, Shackleton took 3 men with him and crossed the Allardyce Range along the spine of the island. They had no map and hoped to reach a whaling station at Stromness. They arrived on May 20, 1916, and a rescue effort was immediately organized for men on the other side of South Georgia and the others on Elephant Island. 3 months later, they were picked up. They made it home without loss of life. Sir Shackleton, upon his return, published his memoirs of the expedition and toured on a lecture circuit. In 1920, he started to think about another expedition. The destination he had in mind was the Arctic in the area of the Beaufort Sea, which was largely unexplored. With funds from a former schoolmate, he acquired the Foca 1, which he renamed Quest. Then he changed his goal and decided to try to circumnavigate the Antarctic continent, including finding the lost islands such as Taranaki. The expedition left September 1921. Many of his former crew from the Endurance sailed with their boss. When they arrived in Rio de Janeiro, it was suspected Shackleton had a heart attack, but he refused a medical examination. The Quest continued onto South Georgia, arriving January 4, 1922. A few hours after midnight, Dr. Macklin, the expedition's physician, was called to Shackleton's cabin. He complained of back pains and that he didn't feel well. According to Macklin's diary, he reminded Shackleton that he should try to lead a regular life. Shackleton asked, "You are always wanting me to give up things. What is it I ought to give up?" Macklin's answer was not new, chiefly alcohol, boss. On January 5, 1922, at 2:50 a.m., Shackleton died from a heart attack. Emily Shackleton, his widow, instructed that her husband be buried in South Georgia instead of Britain, and on March 5, 1922, he was buried at Grytviken Cemetery. Eric Marshall, the medical officer on the 1907-1909 expedition aboard the Nimrod, made a note in his diary that Shackleton suffered a congenital heart defect known as hole in the heart, atrial septal defect. This possibly paired with the strain of the trip caused his death at the age of 47. Shackleton died heavily in debt, and he left his small estate to his widow, who died 14 years later in 1936. According to The Sun, in 2019, the Endurance 22 expedition tried to locate the vessel and sent an unmanned sub which was trapped under the ice, with temperatures dipping to 18 degrees, negative 18 degrees Celsius, the attempt ended in failure. 3 years later, Lady Luck was with them, and the ship was located 2 miles below the surface of the Weddell Sea. In a strange twist, the find coincided with the 100-year anniversary of Shackleton's burial on March 5th. The New York Times wrote, the $10 million cost of the expedition was covered by an anonymous donor. The last years of the 19th century until the end of World War I became known as the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. Many ships and lives were lost in Antarctic crossings, the HMS Terror and Erebus, among others. The Endurance will remain on the seafloor protected by the Antarctic Treaty as a history monument. It shouldn't be unexpected that Shackleton is said not to lie easy in his grave, since he possibly felt there was much he left undone. Sir Edmund Hillary said he met Shackleton's ghost at the Wardy House on Ross Island. The prefabricated hut was shipped from England to Antarctic to house 14 men. Shackleton and his crew built it in 1908. There was an area for dog kennels, horse stables, a meteorological station, and a laboratory. It was stocked with canned and dried food, which included mock turtle soup with raspberries. The supplies were found 100 years after the men left them there. Hillary, who climbed Mount Everest, said, I remember when I first went to Shackleton's hut, and I'm not a person who really sees things very much, but I went inside the door. When I opened the door, it's a rather sort of bare hut inside, but I distinctly saw Shackleton walking towards me and welcoming me, and then it all sort of flashed away, and he was gone. There are reports of slamming doors, items flying off the shelf, and just creepy and a creepy atmosphere overall. Scientific McMurdo Station on Ross Island is said to be haunted by the ghosts of the 1979 Air New Zealand Flight 901 that crashed into Mount Erebus. All 20 crewmen and 237 passengers perished in the crash. A worker told the Timaru Herald in 2007 that ghosts from the Erebus plane haunt the Big Jim. There's also Scott's Hut, located at Cape Evans. This unlucky group of men belonged to an expedition headed by Sir Robert Scott. In 1911, 25 men wintered in the hut and left their base camp on a trek to the South Pole. They died on the return trip only 11 miles from reaching a depot. We shall stick it out to the end, but we are getting weaker, of course, and the end cannot be far. Scott wrote in his final diary entry, it seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. Behind the hut is a memorial erected to the three members of the Ross Sea Party, a support team sent to deploy depots for Shackleton's Endurance crew. It is just a simple cross. Spencer Smith died of scurvy. Two other members of the Ross Sea Party disappeared into a blizzard after they said they were going to walk to Cape Evans. The schooner Jenny left the Isle of Wight in 1823. She was not discovered until 1840, trapped inside an ice barrier of the Drake Passage. Her last port of call was Callao, Peru. Ironically, the whaling ship which discovered it was named Hope. All her crew were aboard but dead and frozen. The last entry in the logbook was dated May 4, 1823, and written by the captain, it read, no food for 71 days. I am the only one left alive. He was found sitting in his chair holding a pen. There were 7 men on the deck frozen solid. Captain Brighton was the first man from the Hope to board the Jenny. There are conflicting reports as to what became of the remains. In one story, the crew, the captain's wife, and dog were buried at sea. In another version, all were left where they were found, and only the logbook was taken. After being found by the Hope, no one else has come across the ill-fated Jenny. Another haunted place is Deception Island, just off the northwest Antarctic Peninsula in the South Shetland Islands. It offers one of the safest harbors in Antarctica, and it's been both a sealing and whaling station, and in later years a site for science and military bases from different countries. It was abandoned after a volcanic eruption destroyed British Base B in 1969. Present day, it is still an active volcano, and research teams visit it only during the summer months. Rusting machinery and structures dot the black sand beaches. There are husks of abandoned places, research stations, plane hangars, military bases, and equipment from the whaling operation found on Whalers Bay. This is the oldest ghost town on the island, used by generations of Norwegian and Chilean whalers. The equipment were left as they were when last used during the 1970s. Present day, the island is home to penguins, seals, whales, and birds. People no longer live there. The cemetery was buried in the 1969 eruption. In 1906, Whalers Bay was an anchorage for whaling factory ships. In 1931, the bottom dropped out of whale oil and the station was abandoned. Present-day Hector Whaling Station is a protected historic site and monument. So yeah, a lot of people, I don't know, I guess, you know, maybe I'm not adventurous, but I don't do well with a cold. But anyway, exciting times, times of discovery. I will be back soon with some more weird and eerie news. Until then.